Second Peter, chapter 2. Now we get to read about these false teachers. This is not what I would call the best chapter in the Bible as far as edification goes. It's much like reading through Lamentations. It is such a, it's an amazing thing to see all that God has done and then to see how many ways in which man has rejected it, been deceived, or whatever else. And that's what we're going to find in this. We're going to find people who most likely, in many cases, have known God, but then have turned away, and then other people who haven't known Him and have just continued in darkness. But it's a tragic thing. He says here in verse 2, "And many shall follow their pernicious ways." Pernicious ways refers to acts of loose conduct. Acts of loose conduct. So it's pointing to reckless, hardened immorality. It is a very strong word. "By reason of whom the way of truth shall be evil spoken of." Now this is showing that as they are living these kind of lives, but yet have some identification outwardly with Christ, then what kind of reproach does that bring upon Christ? It brings terrible reproach. And it's hurting people. When it says, "is evil spoken of, whom the way of truth shall be evil spoken of," the Greek means to blaspheme. And it's showing that their lives, by what they're doing and what they're saying, as far as what is actually occurring, they are blaspheming God. They are blaspheming the name of God because of their ungodliness. And the word in Greek can also mean to rail at or to revile. So they are actually reviling the name of God. They are railing at the name of God by their very lifestyle. Then it says, "And through covetousness shall they with feigned words make merchandise of you." Feigned words, formed words, shaped words, molded words. It's like molding wax or clay. The ideas of words molded at will to suit and to accomplish their vain imaginations. Again, it's a very strong picture. Feigned words. They're words of pretense. They're words where they're pretending. It's so that they can trap the people, so they can accomplish what they want to accomplish. They make merchandise of you. The teachers treat the people as merchandise, as objects by which to enhance their own wealth. This is what's happening. There are a lot of false teachers. There's a lot of false prophets. There's a lot of people into religion because they are making money. The man who started the religion of Scientology, which is totally worthless, totally demonic, he said the best way to make $1 million is to start your own religion. And he makes over $100 million a year through Scientology. $100 million comes in. Now, he doesn't get all of that, but even if he got 15% of it, he's making a lot of money. And I'm sure he gets a lot more than 15% of it. And he was right. And it's a terrible thing to see how people have ended up exploiting other people. That's making merchandise of them. Exploiting them for their money, for their time. Getting them to make sacrifices so that they can be elevated. Not so the people can be elevated, but they. The ones who are making merchandise of the people. It's a real tragic thing. And it says, "whose judgment now of a long time lingereth not, and their damnation slumbereth not." Now the New American Standard translates this, "their judgment from long is not idle, and their destruction is not asleep." Vincent says this, "there is a graphic picture in the sentence. The judgment is not idle. See, it looks like it is. Looks like judgment is not going to come upon these people. But see, that's wrong. Judgment is coming. It's not idle. It is represented as a living thing, awake and expectant. Long ago, that judgment started on its destroying path. And the fate of sinning angels, which you'll talk about, the deluge, that is the flood, which you'll talk about, and the overthrow of Sodom, which you'll talk about, were but incidental illustrations of its power. Nor has it ever since lingered. It advances still, strong and vigilant, as when it sprang from the bosom of God, and will not fail to reach the mark to which it was pointed from of old. So God says, these kind of acts will result in this judgment. And that judgment, you may not see it coming. And it may look like it's idle, as though it's not coming. But it's already set on its course. And it's only a matter of time. And it's not asleep. It's not lingering. It's headed right toward those people. It's a scary thing. It's a serious thing. As one said, to fall into the hands of an angry God. That's what the picture is. The idea is that justice may have seemed to slumber or to linger, but it's not really so. It looks that way today. People are getting away with horrible things. Horrible things. And it looks like no judgment is coming upon them. The judgment is aimed right toward them, and it's on its way. It may look like it's never going to come, but the day of vengeance will come. And those people will stand before God, and they'll wish they had never lived that way. And especially the backslider, he will wish that he had never backslidden. He'll wish that he'd never turned against God. So that's why we've got to see life for what it really is. It's not a game. It's not just a fun time. If you want a fun time, the demons will show you a fun time. And then God will show you a real hot time in the lake of fire. And it won't be good. Very serious things. Judgment had on them an ever watchful eye. And that judgment was on its way, as ordained from of old. See, from the beginning. To do that which is right and just. So that's what he's saying here. People look at it and say, well, no, everything's going on just as always. No judgment. That's ridiculous. That's nonsense. That'll never happen. These things are happening. And they're coming into people's lives, and you read about it every day in the newspaper. It's just that none of those so-called journalists know that it's the judgment of God. They don't realize what it is. They don't realize what it is they're observing. God is allowing a lot of things to take place, and a lot of lives are gone just like that, and there's not quite as much coincidence in it as some people think. There's a lot more God involved, directly and indirectly, saying this is judgment on sin. There's a lot of things like that that are going on. And, you know, I don't know where to put some things. You can talk about certain things and say that it's definitely God, but it's very difficult to say. As an example, they just had another earthquake there in San Francisco yesterday, and it was a fairly strong earthquake. And I don't remember if anybody was killed. I can't remember. I don't think anybody was. But there was a lot of damage. And that city is probably one of the most perverted cities in all the world. That city is a mess. It's a beautiful city. Boy, it's a beautiful city. Beautiful location. Just absolutely picturesque. But it is perverted and messed up like very few cities are. And it is really a horrible place. And so you got this earthquake. Well, is that in some sense judgment from God? Well, you say, well, it's on this fault, and so if that fault moves, well, there's going to be earthquakes. But why did those people decide to build there? Now, they didn't know the fault was there, but they decided to build there. And did God at all have his hand upon them as they built there? God knew the fault was there, and he knew what those people would be after numerous centuries. He knew the kind of people they would be and the kind of lives they would be living. It would not be beyond my understanding of God to have them more or less build right there. And he says, at the end of time, as you're living in your sin, I'm going to just move that fault a little bit, trying to let you see that life is very precarious. And if you don't walk right, you're going to lose out. That wouldn't surprise me in the slightest. It wouldn't surprise me that God's hand is right involved in that. Because he's trying to rescue those people. He doesn't hate those people. He's trying to rescue them. He's trying to rescue all those homosexuals. It's a city of homosexuals, a large percentage of people. And they're anarchists and rebellious. And they're the progressive people. Boy, they are the sinners. They are really a messed up group of people. Not that every single person there in the city is that way, but I wouldn't want to live there. I don't want God to call me there to preach the gospel. David Wilkerson has gone there and preached, and they wanted to beat him up. He faced some real persecution in ministering there. A very, very difficult place. But God might be just saying, well, let me just shake this city a little bit and try to bring somebody back to their senses, try to open their eyes so they might see that life is short. Life is precarious. We've got to go through it the right way. He goes on in verse 4 and he says, for if God spared not the angels that sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved unto judgment, and spared not the old world, but saved Noah, the eighth person, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood upon the world of the ungodly, and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemn them with an overthrow, making them examples unto those that after should live ungodly. And then he delivered just Lot, as far as righteous Lot, vexed with the filthy conversation of the wicked. So he's showing that he did bring judgment. Here's some examples. These are proofs that judgment against the wicked, it's inevitable. That's what it's proving. He spared not. It shows that these angels, despite their rank and the honorable position that they occupied and the holiness they possessed when they were created, were still judged when they sinned. If God would judge angels, then God is going to judge man. If you have these beings in this high and lofty position, and when they turn against God, God judges them, then how much more when you're talking about man who starts out in such a low position? He's going to be judged. It's like saying, as far as somebody having full control over, say, a city, and if he will judge the highest people in the city, and he will really deal with them when they do wrong, well, then of course he's going to deal with the rest. You would generally think, well, he would overlook this and just deal with this. That's the way it oftentimes is in the natural. But if God will deal with these up here, then of course he's going to deal with these. He's going to bring a fair judgment upon all. And it's a very strong thing. If God says, now, he didn't spare the angels, who's man to think that God's going to wink at all of his sin and ignore him when his life demands judgment? Man in sin, his life demands one thing. It demands judgment. God's not going to ignore that. God's not going to say, well, I was just pretending and I'm not really going to do this. There is no such thing as universal salvation. It's heaven and it's hell. And there is a judgment. And this is what he's presenting here. We don't want to ever fall into this. We don't want to ever lose out. We don't want to backslide. We don't want to fall away. We don't want that to happen. But it is possible. It's very much possible. As long as we're alive down on planet Earth, it is a possibility. That's why we have to keep committing, opening up to him. He's working in thousands of ways to make sure that we don't, but it's still going to come down to our own will. Now, he talks about, but cast into chains of darkness, literally, but to pits of gloom, having cast into Tartarus. Now, this is the only place I'm not sure on that. I think this is the only place where the word Tartarus is used. I probably have that here in my notes somewhere, but right offhand, I'm not positive. I think that it is. T-A-R-U-S. Tartarus. But to pits of gloom, having cast into Tartarus. It does not say anything about chains. The word chains is not in the Greek. But to pits of gloom, having cast into Tartarus. Tartarus is not Hades. It is not Sheol. It is not the place of departed spirits. Nor is it where the wicked are finally punished, which is Gehenna. Gehenna is the lake of fire. Sheol is not the lake of fire. Tartarus is not the lake of fire. It's only used here, so this is the only place where it's used. And it's used only of the fallen angels. So it's only used of demons. It's a place for them. You can also know with this Jude verse 6. Jude verse 6. It's probably a place of restraint. And probably a place of darkness in the spirit realm. Now the point is this. It's a point you're all very familiar with. So don't let the word Tartarus kind of, well, what is that? Don't be overwhelmed by this Greek word. It's showing that the demons do not possess liberty to do as they please. They do not have that kind of liberty. They are very much confined, and they can only do what God will allow. And of course, in a sense, they can only do what man will allow. But that's always under the auspices of God. You see, they are far below what they once possessed. They do not have the same light. They do not have the same revelation. They do not have the same glory. They have lost these things. They are detained. They are definitely restricted by God. And that's because of the rebellion. They are in a place of gloom. If we went to visit this place, we'd say, boy, no thanks. We're talking about gloom. We're talking about darkness. We're talking about what sin produces. What does sin produce in major cities? Look at the slums. Look at the Skid Row areas. Look at First Avenue. Dingy. It's gloomy. Look at the people's faces. People aren't smiling down there. They look like they just as soon kill you, say hello. It's awful. You don't go down there. You don't take your family down there. We're going to take a little stroll down First Avenue. Come on, Casey. Come on, Abigail. That'll be a lot of fun. It'll be a real fun time, real pleasant time. It's not fun. It's horrible. It's awful. It's a mess. It's filled with sin. It's gloomy. It's dingy. It's dark. It's twisted. Well, if that's what man is in his sin, what are the demons in their sin? They've got to be in the same kind of a place. They've got to be. They're not up there with God still, able to look and see what he's doing and somehow share in some of his glory and his splendor. They don't share in any of that. They do not share in that at all. They have no place with God. They only come in and say, can we go down and beat up on this guy? And God sometimes reluctantly says, yeah, go ahead. That's what we need done. He's doing this in his pride or whatever. We don't know all that's transpiring, but they are not sharing in anything that is good. They are in a place of restriction, and it is gloomy. Chains of darkness should read pits of darkness. That's how it reads according to the best manuscripts. This seems to give a description to what Tartarus is. Tartarus is these pits of darkness. So it's giving a description. Darkness is the condition which prevails in Tartarus. So he brought them down into pits of darkness to be reserved in then it goes on and it talks about being reserved in this judgment. But so it's delivered into pits of darkness, and then it also mentions Tartarus. And it read literally, but to pits of gloom having cast into Tartarus. And so the pits of gloom, the pits of darkness, is what's describing Tartarus. The Greek for darkness means blackness. It's the densest of darkness. It also gives the idea of gloom, the densest of darkness. That shows how great their sin is. So when you're up here and you sin, where do you end up? You fall way, way down. When you turn against great light, totally, with knowledge, a complete about face, where does that pathway lead? It leads to the densest darkness. That's exactly what has happened to people who have known God. It's exactly what has happened. It's a terrible thing. So the demons now live and exist in this terribly darkened spiritual state. There's no light or revelation. They do not have light, and they do not have revelation. That's why God is able to use them against themselves all the time. God uses these demons against themselves. They don't know what they're really doing. They're so filled with hate. They're so against us, but they don't realize that God's manipulating them. God is manipulating these demons. The demons are making a bride of Christ. If those demons knew what they were really doing, they would say, forget it, we're not going to do this anymore. See, they don't know how God is using them. God is outwitting them at every single point. If man will only keep trusting God, he'll see that God is outwitting the demons at every single point. And every threat of these demonic spirits actually turns to God's advantage. But see, we've got to keep our eyes on God or it doesn't seem that way. And it sure doesn't feel that way. And it doesn't look that way. But it's the way it is. It really is the truth. Then he says, they're reserved unto judgment. It says, now, see, they are in a place of judgment, but they're also awaiting their final judgment. These pits of gloom, which make up Tartarus, that shows they have already received a certain judgment. This is just part of the judgment. The judgment they will get finally is far worse than being put in Tartarus. This is what he talks about in Matthew chapter 25 and verse 41. Matthew 25, verse 41. Also Revelation 20 and verse 10. The dark pits, that's the present judgment. But they're also being kept for a further future judgment. So they're experiencing a present judgment. They're restricted. They are experiencing right now a judgment. Even though they're active, they're still under a judgment right now. In a place of darkness. Very much restricted. And they're also being held for a further judgment, a final judgment. Okay, then he mentions Noah, talking about the flood. And then he says in verse 6, going on to verse 6, and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, the word turning means reducing. He reduced the city to ashes. He took these cities and made them into ashes. It shows the severity and the consequences of what must be done by God because of sin. He reduced the city to ashes. Just reduced the city. That was it. All that was left was ashes. Just ruins. Nothing was left of any substance, of any value. He says that he made them an example. That's what the Greek means, where it says example. God did not do this just to establish an example for future ungodly souls. So don't read that into it and make that the only thing that God did there. He did it first because it's what they deserved. They deserve this punishment. God wasn't looking down and saying, well, you don't really deserve this, but for future ungodly souls, I'm going to just kind of wipe you out. You'll have to forgive me, but I just feel I need to do this for other people, for their sake. That is not what he did. He did it because of what they were doing and what they deserved, and then he has further used it as an example. God is not doing this to somebody, blessing them or being mean to them, to show other people how he blesses and how he's mean. That's not how God does it. God deals with the people where they are, and then he will also use it as an example. That's the way God always works. God isn't going to say, well, okay, I hate to do this to you, Leslie, but I'm going to have the elders put you out of the church. And you're not really that bad, but you got some problems. And I know others have problems too, but it's for an example. And you'll have to kind of forgive me for it. And I know it's not the best way, but it's what I decided, and I'm God, and I can do what I want. So they'll be over to your house, and they'll be letting you know that you're out of the church. And God would never do that. That's not God. God does not do such things. Now, God will have somebody put out of the church because that's what they deserve. They won't repent. They won't follow the church government. They won't follow the word of God. So they have to be put out of the church. And then God will also use it as an example. He'll use it as a warning to the rest of us. But he won't have somebody just put out indiscriminately. They didn't deserve it. It wasn't. He went way overboard. Shouldn't have done this. It should only have been a little slap on the hand. But instead of that, he just destroys the whole city. He won't do that. God will never do such a thing. That's not God. That's a completely wrong picture of God. Then he talks about Lot, and he says he delivered Lot. Now, Kenneth Weiss translates it, and righteous Lot, completely worn down by the manner of life of the lawless, in the sphere of unbridled lust. That's what Sodom and Gomorrah were. Unbridled lust. He delivered. Lot was worn out. It was hard to live where Lot was living. Now, was it God's will for Lot to live there? No, it sure wasn't. But God still worked to rescue him. Now, we've pitched our tents real close to Sodom. We've taken a few trips to Sodom. We've bought some of the merchandise of Sodom. We've talked to the Sodomites. We've seen what it was like in Gomorrah. We've taken a lot of journeys to places. It was never God's will. We've done it since we've been saved and Spirit-filled. Quite a number of times. But yet God is still working to deliver us. He still loves us. And that's the way it was toward Lot, as far as God's heart toward him. The word delivered in Greek means to draw out, or to snatch, to draw or to snatch to oneself. It shows God did the rescuing. He drew Lot out. He did it. God will rescue those. He'll do everything he can to rescue them. The word just means righteous, and it shows how God counted Lot. But didn't Lot have sin? Of course. Do we have sin? Of course. How does God count us? He counts us as righteous because we're trusting him. Well, he wasn't trusting perfectly. God still counted him as righteous. We're not trusting perfectly, and God still counts us as righteous. God is not a legalist. There's a spirit to the law. There's the heart of God. There's the love of God. I'm glad that the law was inside the ark, covered by the mercy seat. That's a real blessing. If it was on the outside and we all had to match up to it before we could get the mercy, we'd be in a lot of trouble. When it says that Lot was vexed, literally means to tire down with toil, or to exhaust with labor, or to be sore distressed. This is what Lot was feeling in his heart toward the open and shameless ungodliness which was being practiced around him. Well, then, Lot, why don't you just leave the city? Well, why don't we just leave the city? You know, we know certain things aren't quite right. We know that we should have more faith, that this is the way we should live in this situation. We should talk this way. We should act this way. But just knowing it doesn't seem to be enough, does it? Doesn't seem to be enough. Unless God comes and adds to that knowledge with his delivering power, we'll probably end up stuck in the city. So there's a combination of what we're learning, knowing, feeling, and also calling upon him. It takes both. You can label something, that's wrong. Well, why am I doing it? This is right. Then why aren't I doing that? This I hate. Why am I doing it? I know this is what I really like and really want, and this is God's will. So why aren't I doing it? You ever read Romans chapter 7? Same thing. Romans chapter 7. Here's Lot experiencing Romans chapter 7 right there in Sodom. God says, I know how to get you out. I'll get you out. I'll do it. It shows God's heart. God's really for us. It's a very powerful picture. It says their filthy conversation. The word filthy in Greek means unbridled lust. Unbridled lust. Conversation means their whole manner of life. Boy, that was a horrible city. I don't know if you saw that movie, The Bible, that we showed here a few months ago, but boy, I couldn't even watch the pictures when they were showing Sodom in that movie. That just gave me the creeps. That made me just feel so awful. Oh, I mean, I wish they hadn't have represented it quite that way. It's like looking out today and seeing the punk rockers and this other kind of stuff. Same kind of thing. It's just, oh, it's terrible. Oh, it's awful. Unbridled lust. Messed up. Demonized. That's where the world is headed. Deceived by sorceries, by drugs. Our whole world is being deceived by drugs. A lot of it's coming through medicine. Legitimate kind of drugs. The Valium, the tranquilizers, the pep pills, diet pills, all sorts of legitimate drugs are part of the deception of drugs. It really is. It's part of it. That's why we've got to really find more and more, as much as possible, Jesus Christ as our great physician. So that we don't ever get hooked on some of these drugs. People get hooked on drugs inadvertently. They don't mean to get hooked on them. And it can cause some real problems spiritually as well. Remember Don's testimony about the problems he was having with the pain and the things with the using just pain pills. Do you remember that testimony? Boy, I wished I knew when that was. You would all do well in hearing that. And here's our pastor. And he was having all these pains with the shingles and the tension. And he was using certain drugs, which are just legitimate medicines. But it was a demonic scheme against our pastor to get him dependent upon those drugs, to get him dependent upon those medicines. And you can't fault him for using those. He's got his ministry. He's calling upon God for healing, but he's got to continue on in the ministry. He needs some relief to continue in the ministry. He can't seem to get it from heaven. What else do you do? There's times that it's about the only thing they know to do. That's why we wear glasses. It's why we take things maybe for our sinuses or for colds or certain things so we can go to our job. We can't seem to get healing from heaven. We do believe God, but we do need relief. And what else do I do right now? Well, the devil knows how to come in and start working some of these situations over to his advantage. And I can't remember exactly how it came to him, but Don started to realize there were demons involved in this. And those demons were saying, you get rid of those medicines, and we're going to be able to do this to your body. And he started to see that there was a link involved in this whole thing. He went into the medicine cabinet, took all those right down in the garbage. See? But it was just a real clever step-by-step strategy. Now, if our pastor is going to be attacked, where it shows the devil out to destroy him, then it's obvious that the devil must be out to destroy us as well, that are members of the congregation under whom this pastor is supposed to be leading and guiding. And so we need to learn from that in our own lives. And some things that aren't that look legitimate maybe aren't quite as legitimate as we thought. Maybe a certain thing that's labeled as neutral, maybe it's not quite as neutral as we thought. There are very definite strategies of the devil. See, he's got to get thinking in here that we will accept as our thinking. Somehow he's got to get it in here so we accept it as ours and legitimate. And then we'll do it. But if we really know it's demonic and it's out to destroy us, we won't do it. But he's got to get it in here so it makes sense. Seems reasonable. That is rational. No, it's not. It sounds like it, though. And it may feel like it based on how we're viewing the situation, the circumstances. I just mention that because there's a lot of things that go on where we look at one thing as the strategy of the devil. Here's the devil trying to deceive the world with drugs. Well, obviously that's the marijuana, the cocaine, and heroin, and things like that. But what about this? It's where the magician has got you looking at the right hand and he's doing everything with the left hand. It's pretty clever. It's the tail coming around behind the stars to capture him and throw him to the earth. There he is with his big growly face and you never see the tail. That's the devil. That's the way the devil works. That's exactly why it's pictured that way. Those people don't realize that they're being captured by the devil and being thrown into his system. They don't realize that. They're not aware of it. They get trapped. That's called deception. When you're deceived, you don't know you're deceived. That's why you're deceived. That's how the devil works. He's doing this. He's doing this all the time. It's his business. It's the con artist. He knows how to sell you the lake property in the Sahara Desert. People buy it. There's not a whole lot of lake property in the Sahara, but people buy it. Spiritually speaking, of course, I don't think anybody's actually buying lake property in the Sahara. At least I hope not. At least none of you. verse 8, for that righteous man dwelling among them in seeing and hearing vexed his righteous soul from day to day with their unlawful deeds, further emphasizes their sin. The word vexed here is a different word than verse 7. Here it means to torment, to torture. He was tormented and tortured. Vexed his righteous soul. These demons, through their sin, of all these people around about him, it was tormenting his soul. That's exactly what the devil does to us. He wants to torment us. The devil is—he's the commandant of the concentration camp. He's the commander there. He wants to get us in the concentration camp, and then he wants to torture us and torment us. It's exactly what he does to people. This is why some people have nervous breakdowns. They're being tortured by the devil. The devil knows how to torture people, so we've got to be free in God. Verse 9: The Lord knoweth how to deliver the godly out of temptation, and reserve the unjust unto the day of judgment. He knows how to deliver. God knows how to set us free. He knows how to get us through the fiery trials. There's a marvelous demonstration of his power and his wisdom and his ability to thoroughly outwit the devil. The devil has us right in his hands, and God pulls us right out. See, that's the meaning of the Greek word harpazo. Harpazo, for rapture. The catching away of the saints. And he catches away the man-child. Harpazo means, just like a branch or some sort of a valuable document or something falls into the fire, and you reach in quickly to snatch it before it burns up. That's the picture in the Greek for that word. It's a quick snatching. If you didn't get it right now, it'd be burned up. It'd be lost. Well, that's just the predicament that the church is going to be in. The church is going to have power. It's going to be an army. It's going to be a bride. But the devil is breathing down its neck. And we've done our work. And if God doesn't come quick to take us home, the picture is we wouldn't make it. That's what the picture is. The picture is we'd be devoured. We may lose out. The church is going to be bowed over with demonic pressures. And then it will unbow itself and will do a work for God, but then the onslaught of the devil will continue to get great. Because you see, what's going to happen is this. See, after the man-child has his ministry, then you're going to have those who've said yes and those who basically will say no. Now, once they've made their decision to say no, then they open back up to all the demons. And the number who say no is going to be more than the number who says yes. So who's going to really be bringing the flood now? It's going to be the flood of iniquity. You're going to have that further demonic onslaught. So once the people have said no and they don't want to hear anymore, if we stayed around much longer, they'd come to devour us. That's what the picture is. So he's got to catch us away. But see, he knows how to do that. He knows how to deliver, and he knows exactly when to do it. The devil will think then, well, now that I've got all these who have said no, now I can use them and have them turn against these people. And they're not going to be able to do anything more. Well, that's right, they're not going to be able to do anything more. But they're not going to stay here to get beat up either. They're going to be taken to be on another shore. Now some won't go. And who turns on them? These people have said no. These dupes of the devil. And that's the two witnesses. And that's the seed of the woman. And God is there to protect, as far as protecting her soul, but she has to give her life. Those saints have to give their lives as martyrs. And I don't want to be part of that. I'm at least this week, I'm not into martyrdom. I don't know how you feel about that, but we need to be ready. We need to be in a place where God can deliver us and take us out. But He knows how to do it. He knows exactly how to do it. And it's no problem to God. He has the power. He is well able to do so. Verse 10, but chiefly them that walk after the flesh, in the lust of uncleanness and despise governments, presumptuous are they, self-willed. They are not afraid to speak evil of dignities. Well, that's what we're seeing in our world. They despise governments. They're presumptuous. The word presumptuous means daring. They're not dreading or shunning through fear anything. It shows somebody who's standing up with a real boldness. But it's in stupidity. It's in ignorance. It's where they're blinded. Like a guy on drugs thinking that he can stiff arm a Kenworth truck down the freeway. That's just about what people end up feeling. That's what drugs can do to people's minds. They begin to think with certain drugs they're invincible. That's why you find out some people end up wrapping their car around the cement blockhead there on the bridge or something, or around the telephone pole. They started to drive that car thinking they were invincible, and their mind is gone. And, of course, they're going to kill themselves. And that's the exact strategy of the devil, is to destroy them. Well, this is showing people being demonized. This is a picture of demonized people. And it's getting more and more like this. But it's a scary thing to walk out in public. Here's a couple of people on their honeymoon in Mexico. Some guy comes up, he's going to rob them, robs them for $1.70, and then kills the wife and shoots the husband over $1.70. Now, why didn't he just take the money and leave? Why do you have to shoot him? He's demonized, that's why. It's not reasonable, it's not rational. But you see so much of it on TV, read about it, hear about it. It's no big thing to just pull that trigger. Nobody understands what death really is. Terrible situation. They stand against the dignities, speak evil of dignities. The Greek word for dignities is doxa, D-O-X-A. Literally, glories. It's showing those in exalted positions. It's speaking about the leaders, whether it's presidents, prime ministers, princes, whoever. Whether it's people in the Senate or Parliament, but their dignities, their glories. They have high positions. People think nothing of ridiculing them. Here's the newspapers. I mean, they are so backwards. Here's this guy, and they show the president. He's walking along, and he tripped. Falls down and skins his knee or something. And they have a picture of that. But then the picture of the guy, and he was at a meeting, and he fell asleep. Here I saw one there, the prime minister of Japan, and he fell asleep at a meeting. So they have that in the newspaper. Picture of him, he fell asleep, as though that was something that no other human being had ever done. Why show him making his mistakes? Why show him flubbing like that? Why? It's the attitude. It shows no respect. No respect. Picture people in their worst things. Talk about their worst things. That's why the National Enquirer makes millions and millions and millions of dollars. Shows people in all their weaknesses and adds to them all. They just add all sorts of other things to even make it more for the curiosity seeker and more for the gossiper. It's a terrible thing. Terrible situation. We see the devil trying to do the same thing in the church. So instead of us seeing Christ in one another, we see the flesh. See the demons. Then we criticize, belittle, demean, ridicule. But it all can be in a real kind of subtle way. but all sorts of jabs. We're not here with knives, stilettos, sticking one another. We're supposed to be here with a healing balm to comfort one another. We don't want this. This is terrible. We don't want to speak evil of dignities. We want to speak well of our pastor. We want to speak well of our teachers. We want to speak well of the elders. We want to speak well of one another. If somebody flubs, some things are humorous. But, you know, really, a teacher, just as an example, we can live through this, but just as an example. Here's a teacher, let's say he ministers 3 hours a day in Bible college. And he's going to say some wrong things. He's going to mispronounce words. He's going to flub. He's going to goof. And some things are funny. But when we leave the classroom, do you really think that that's the thing that we should then tell to all of our dorm mates? Now, today in my class, this is what I got out of the class. Let me tell you the bonehead thing my teacher did. Now, it would never be said quite that way, but that, in effect, is what is actually said. Instead of saying, boy, that was wonderful. We learned this in 1 Corinthians, and oh, this was such a marvelous truth. Here we are remembering he interposed his words or misstated it or lost his train of thought or some other thing. See, it just shows how easy it is to really view the wrong thing and then talk about the wrong thing. And I'm not saying it's malicious or that it should never be done. There's times I find some of the things I've done rather humorous in a bonehead way. And you know, we just have to live with those things. That's fine. It's not that big of a thing. But, you know, in some situations, then some of these things come back to the teachers. And the devil knows how to take that and bring this kind of feeling like, you mean that's all that my class did? You mean that's all that's remembered? And of course it's not. Of course it's not. But that's how the devil can take these kind of things. And that's how some things get back to your friends. When they find out you said this about them. And you may not have said it quite that way, but that's how it gets back to them. It's just, we need to be a little bit more careful sometimes. I haven't been getting all sorts of things back to me, and so you're the class that did it, and I'm really upset at you. I'm just giving you an example. And it could apply to the pastor's sermon or somebody's testimony. We just need to be more thoughtful as to, okay, now when they're up there and they make that mistake, then what if I come and kind of make some comment about that? That just adds to it. They already feel bad about that. They wish they hadn't made that mistake, but what should I really get out of that? Is that what I should remember about that? No, that's not what I should remember. I should remember this good part and the part that encouraged me. It would help in some situations if we just would do a little bit more thinking before we spoke. And realize that our words will mean something to somebody. And they can either be helpful words, or they can be words that hurt. And it's just things to consider. And we've all, I'm sure, failed in this to some degree. But more and more, we're going to be just so much more careful with one another's feelings. And we're not going to want to do anything that would put them in a bad light, or in some sort of a negative light. And to see this picture, they don't even care. They'll just speak about the people any way they want. That's the spirit of the age. It's becoming commonplace. It says in verse 11, whereas angels, which are greater in power and might, bring not railing accusation against them before the Lord. Angels do not bring blasphemous judgment against these dignities. It's referring directly back to verse 10. Now, these dignities, some of them are making horrendous mistakes. Terrible mistakes. Awful mistakes. But the angels don't judge them. The angels don't come over to God and say, did you see what he did? It's not like little brother tattling on big sister or little sister tattling on big brother. The angels aren't tattletales. That's the work of the demons. The angels aren't doing that. Even if they see mistakes. It's a wonderful thing to know that people with the heart of God come to the defense of other saints. That's a wonderful thing. We already know our failings. We have to live with them. We face them every day. But for somebody to come and see right past that and see Christ and talk about how they see Christ in that person, that's a real blessing. And I'm glad that's happening. It's happening more and more in our church. And it's going to continue to happen. And it's going to be a real strength in our church. Verse 12, he says, "But these, as natural brute beasts, made to be taken and destroyed, speak evil of the things that they understand not." They don't even understand what they're talking about. "And shall utterly perish in their own corruption." These people are just like creatures without reason. Brute beasts. Creatures without reason. It's as though they were born as mere animals to be taken and destroyed. And so that's what sin will do to people's lives. And it's speaking of the false teachers. They live as ones who are irrational and unreasoning. They speak evil of all sorts of things that they don't even understand. But to speak evil, no big deal. Isn't it amazing how people seem to know everything about every subject and can criticize everybody, criticize the president, criticize the Congress, criticize this guy, criticize this athlete, this actor, whoever. It makes no difference. There's always a critic. And everybody reads the critic, the movie critic. Well, who's he? He says, it's a good movie. What's he know about a good movie? He's just telling you what his little teeny pea brain thinks on it. That's all he's telling. And then people give him credence. That's ridiculous. They spend months preparing a play for Broadway. And if they don't get good reviews the first night, they close the whole thing down. This has happened with a lot of big-name actors in plays where they have put a lot of money into it. You got poor reviews night one, there was no night two. Isn't that amazing? They live and die by those reviews. And who are those people? Who are those people that are giving the reviews? I mean, what do they really know? And they stand as though they were God. It's terrible to see people with such power, that their pen has that much power, their own view has that much power. Then if God says something, they just wipe that away. That doesn't mean a thing. Preacher says something from the Word of God, that doesn't mean a thing. This guy here, he may be against those people. He may have something against somebody. He might have a grudge. That might be the reason he wrote it. They're not unbiased, that's for sure. And they open one night, close the next. Isn't that incredible? Isn't that amazing? It's a phenomenal thing. And they probably have certain kind of contracts that might have guarantees where they still have to pay lots of money. So they won't even keep it running. Got poor reviews and close it. That's kind of an amazing thing. That's what the devil would do with you the first time you testified. He'll be glad to critique your first testimony so there won't be a second testimony. He'll be glad to write the reviews on your first sermon. Your first sermon, he'll say, "Well, that was awful." He's probably right. Probably wasn't very good. But that isn't God then saying, "Close down shop." It's just like the devil. It's a very good picture of what the devil does. People read what he says about it and say, "Oh, I guess that must be the truth. I guess I better stop witnessing. Better get out of this ministry. Better stop." That is not the guy to listen to. Those people, those demons don't know what they're talking about. God calls you. He knows you're going to make a mess of things along the way. But he still has his grace and his mercy there to take care of it. Love covers a multitude of failings, multitude of sin. Covers a multitude of botches. We botch a lot of things, but God's still there. But isn't that amazing? You have things like that in life. How can such things be? How can people have such power on things where they may not necessarily know that much about it? But everybody thinks they're the expert. A lot of so-called experts. He wrote a book. So what? Anybody can write a book. I can write a book. And you can write a book. And you might even get somebody to publish it. Somebody might be dumb enough to publish it. It's an amazing situation. Well, what that has to do with this, I'm not sure, but I know I had your interest. That's amazing. Well, we will get done with most of 2 Peter tomorrow.